This is a Federal News Network podcast.
A published report cites Labor Department records showing the U.S. Postal Service has regularly shortchanged hourly employees to the tune of nearly $700,000 in back pay. According to my next guest, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Alexia Fernandez-Campbell is a reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, and she joins me now with the rest of the story. Ms. Fernandez-Campbell, good to have you on.
It's great to be here.
All right, tell us what you found here with respect to the Postal Service altering time cards put in by letter carriers who had to work overtime just because they have to work overtime.
Yes, it was really interesting because I got the Department of Labor data, and I was kind of struck because USPS was one of the employers that had the most violations. So I thought, you know, this might be a story to look into. And then so I started talking to letter carriers. I was able to get my hands on arbitration records showing that, yeah, this is like a really widespread practice. And it seemed like the common thread here was that supervisors would just change time cards to show letter carriers working fewer hours. Many letter carriers didn't know about it. Some did, and they would try to fight it and file grievances. And even when they did file grievances, they might get their money back, but the supervisors just kept doing it and they wouldn't get punished.
I guess the question then arises, do carriers have the right to simply use overtime because they need to finish their work? Or is there some mechanism maybe that they have to check in advance for getting overtime?
Yeah, that's a good question, because under federal law, if they're working overtime, they have to get paid for it. But yeah, USPS has precarious financial problems. So what's happening is USPS does not want to spend on overtime because it's so expensive. It's time and a half, but they don't have enough letter carriers. You know, right now they're delivering packages for Amazon. And during the pandemic, that skyrocketed because everyone was ordering online. So now letter carriers are like, we can't finish our routes within 8 hours. It's impossible. So we have to work overtime. So they're stuck in this situation where their supervisors want them to finish their routes, but it takes so long that they need to do it with overtime. So they have to take overtime. But yeah, they're supposed to get approval, but they also, their supervisors just want them to finish their routes.
So sounds like the supervisors are also in some sort of a pinch too, because they have to control the overtime costs. They're also responsible for the completion of the work in a shift. So it sounds like they're a little bit squeezed here too.
Yeah, it's like a really, really terrible situation, because like USPS leadership is saying, we don't want you to keep spending billions of dollars on overtime. And supervisors, they're under a lot of pressure, and like their annual raises, bonuses, all depend on keeping these overtime costs down. So that's kind of what letter carriers think is pushing supervisors to start basically stealing their money.
Yeah, I guess you get what you incentivize is the old story. So the supervisors then were doing what? Someone put in for, say, 46 hours in a week or something, mm-hmm. and the supervisors only wanted to pay them 40. What did they do? Did they alter the time card, or is this an electronic system? How did this all work mechanically?
The way it works is, you know, the mail carriers, they have these badges that they swipe when they clock in, when they like go out on their route, when they finish their route, when they finish other tasks, and then when they leave at the day they clock out again. So from what I saw from records and interviews, there were different ways that this would happen. The most common was, like you just said, that supervisors will go in there and just delete hours to show them either working 40 hours only, or maybe just they'll shave off a few hours of overtime, maybe not all of them, but anything just to keep the cost low. Other times they would just clock out carriers while they're out still on their route. So they could actually go into the system and just clock them out. And many times letter carriers weren't aware of that. And then another situation was that some supervisors were just telling mail carriers, hey, if you're going to stay out past 6 p.m., which is when everyone's supposed to be back, then you need to clock yourself out and keep working. So some of it was very obvious and direct, and other was like kind of sneaky.
We're speaking with Alexia Fernandez-Campbell. She's a reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Now, the Labor Department data that you looked at showed 1,150 cases to the tune of, as we mentioned at the top, nearly $700,000. But you found that one, even those cases weren't all resolved in a way that looks fair, but that was only part of the problem. So tell us more about what happened with the Labor Department grievances, and then what else you found that went beyond those 1,150 cases.
The Labor Department violations, which it was something I didn't realize before, but so let's say an employee files a complaint with the Labor Department, say, hey, for example, USPS owes me this much money. Labor Department will investigate. And then supposedly at the very least, Labor Department, if they find it's like actually did happen, then the employer is supposed to at least pay back the money. And what happens is the Labor Department negotiates with the agency, or at least with USPS, they're doing this. they're negotiating it so that the USPS only pays back like half of it, which doesn't make sense to me because if by law you're supposed to pay employees for all their hours, I don't understand why the Labor Department is negotiating a lower amount. So that's what was happening.
Yeah, interesting. And then there is the issue of the Association of Letter Carriers, the union. Yeah. What has that union done to intervene here? Or can they do anything about this?
So I think the union has a lot of power here. I was surprised that the union was not, at least the top leaders were not very forthcoming. They did not want to talk about this. There are three different postal worker unions and no one wanted to talk about this. So I ended up having to talk to like lower level union, you know, like union stewards. And so what happens is that, you know, these union stewards, they've been finding a lot of these time card changes and they've been taking these cases to arbitration. And, you know, they'll fight it and they'll say, look, you know, because arbitration is part of their contract. They're supposed to fight this in, you know, in arbitration. So they'll say, look, these supervisors are changing all these time cards. So the arbitrator will say, yes, so the common thing was arbitrator would say, yes, this is widespread wage theft. Okay, so you need to stop doing this, USPS. And then the union will be like, yeah, but they haven't even fired these supervisors or disciplined them in any way. We want more than just back pay and a promise that it won't happen again. And the arbitrator's like, I'm sorry, under the contract, we can't order the USPS to discipline their employees. So that's how the supervisors keep getting away with it.
Right. So the arbitrator can issue a finding, but they don't really have an enforcement mechanism.
Exactly. Exactly.
And what did the Postal Service itself tell you when you asked them about this? They must have said something.
Well, at first they didn't respond to me. And I was like, this is very strange because usually, you know, at least an agency will release a comment. So I kept following up and I was like, okay, I think you really should at least say something. And then USPS is like, okay, we're going to get back to you. They didn't answer all my questions, but they did release a statement saying that they take these kinds of allegations of time card changes very seriously. So acknowledge that, you know, obviously this is happening. And that the messaging from USPS leadership has always been to supervisors that you cannot do that. You cannot change time cards without, like, you know, having a legit reason that's approved by the letter carriers. And they said that they specifically say that. So I guess they're kind of saying it's not leadership's fault.
All right. And what has the reaction been outside of the Postal Service and the arbitrators and the union? Have you gotten any reaction, say, from the Hill or any other quarters so far?
You know, it's interesting because usually I do with these kinds of stories, I'll get reaction from everyone, whatever agency I'm writing about. But in this case, I actually got so much response from letter carriers themselves. Like, I've never gotten so much response to a story. It's mail carriers all across the country telling me, oh, my goodness, I didn't realize that, or I thought I was alone. I thought this was just happening to me. I thought I was going crazy. Or others saying this has been happening for like 30 years, or even retired mail carriers saying I had to fight so much. So honestly, like, I've been getting more response from within USPS. I haven't really, at least not that I know of, heard of much response outside.
And any follow-up plans that you've got?
Yeah, so one thing I want to look into is like the bonus system, because all the mail carriers tell me, they're like, yeah, like our supervisors are making tons of money off these bonuses that they get for keeping overtime costs low, for keeping like our routes to run on time. And they're like, so in a way, they're like really benefiting from wage theft. So, you know, I haven't been able to confirm those reports, because it's all been like word of mouth. So I'm going to look into see if there's some way I can show what supervisors are getting out of all this.
Yeah, sounds like almost robbing Paul to pay Peter.
Exactly, yeah.
All right. Alexia Fernandez-Campbell is a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
We'll post this interview along with a link to her report at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive at Podcast One or wherever you get your shows.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I am your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Vice Admiral Cutler Dawson. Cutler has had an incredible career serving our country for 35 years in the Navy, where he attained the rank of Vice Admiral. And during his service, he had numerous assignments afloat and ashore, including Commander, Second Fleet, Striking Fleet Atlantic, and in Washington at the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill, where he was the Navy's Chief of Legislative Affairs. Immediately following his retirement from active duty in 2004, he became the president and CEO of Navy Federal Credit Union, the world's largest credit union, where he served for 14 years. Under his leadership, Navy Federal grew from 2 million to 8 million members. Phenomenal. Cutler, welcome and thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Shane.
You've had a fascinating career across both military and the private sector. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and your professional journey?
Well, I started out at the Naval Academy, where I graduated in 1970, and then, as you mentioned, spent 35 years in the Navy with six actual afloat commands. The first one was when I was 27 years old. I didn't know enough to be scared of anything, and it was probably one of the highlights of my career. And then after I retired, after 35 years, I went to work at Navy Federal Credit Union as the CEO, where I spent my next 14 years. I'm currently retired and enjoying life, and it's been a great run for me.
How would you describe your leadership style, and how's that developed over the years?
My style has been quite consistent. I believe, and I've learned this in the Navy, that you have to go to the deck plates to see what is going on. And you have to learn what your people do and how they do it so you can help them to be better at it and more efficient and more productive. It's something that you need to do all the time. I remember I used to tell folks that you don't want to retreat to your cabin. And what I mean by that is the longer you're in a position, the less you think you have to get out and about. But that should be the opposite. You should get out and about more, because people change, situations change, and you've got to figure out a way to get to them and find out what they're doing and what you can do to help them.
We'll talk a little bit more about your book, but I read it, From Sea to the C-Suite. Fantastic read. You talk about the deck plates in that as well. I would encourage everyone to get a copy of this and read some more detail about going to the deck plates. Cutler, who was the most impactful leader in your life, and what quality did you admire about them?
I had numerous while I was in the Navy, but the quality that I enjoyed the most was the leaders that got to know me as an individual, and that they cared about me, and I could tell that they cared about me. And they were not only my leaders, but they were my mentors. And I remember one particular one, Bill Schiffer, when I had my first assignment at the Pentagon. I would go in to see him with my problem of the day, and I knew that he had numerous problems of his own, but he would stop, and he would focus on me, and he would make me feel like I was the most important person in his world. And I tried to do that throughout my career. But really, it's about caring for your people.
Cutler, in reading your book, there was a quote you used that you used to inspire those people that work for you. And it really got my attention. And it was, you are the captain of your own ship. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what that means and how it was useful to you and the leaders you were developing.
Absolutely. What I mean by captain of your own ship, when you are the captain of a ship, sometimes you're in the middle of the ocean and you don't have anybody to turn to make decisions. You don't have anybody to turn to ask, what should I do now? You have to be the captain of that ship. And I translated that into, let's say, Navy Federal's organization, where I would tell branch managers that I said, you are the captain of the ships of Navy Federal. You're the ones that are facing the members or customers, as others call them, every day. And you have to make decisions without a lot of guidance in some cases and without a lot of time. So be the captain of your own ship. Step up, make decisions, do what you think is right, and you never can go wrong.
I think that is so important. And you have to give your people a little bit of latitude to take some risk as well, because there is risk for them in doing that and risk to your organization.
That's right. And I mentioned that I took command of my first ship with 5 years in the Navy, and I was 27 years old. Well, my boss had 32 years in the Navy, and his guidance to me when I first met him was, Cutler, you do the right thing, and I'll back you up all the way. What a wonderful way to spend an assignment with backup and guidance like that.
What great advice. It's clear leadership is a topic you're passionate about. You wrote the book we mentioned before, From Sea to C-Suite. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yes. When I was at Navy Federal, I would tell sea stories as parables to get my point across. And folks would tell me, Cutler, we like your stories. It gives us a picture of what you're trying to tell us. Now, what else are they going to say? They work for me, but I took it as a compliment, and it was. And my wife encouraged me to write a book, and I needed a co-author to help me. And I found a lady named Taylor Keelan, who was the perfect, perfect co-author. She turned in my stories into wonderful chapters that I'm very proud of.
Where can listeners find a copy?
Well, you can get it on Amazon, and you can also get it on the Naval Institute website. And I might add that any proceeds from the book, Navy Federal uses to give to charity.
Fantastic. Cutler, thank you very much. Really enjoyed your time and your lessons in leadership and sharing with us your life story. And I've learned a lot both from talking to you today and reading your book. And thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. And I would like to add one thing, if I could, Shane. During my assignments in Washington, D.C., I gained the utmost respect for the civilians that work here every day. They're hardworking, they're dedicated, and they have my eternal gratitude. I got to come and go from the Pentagon. They stayed every day and worked in Washington when I got to go out and enjoy being at sea.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, WAPO serves civilian federal employees, but your comment is well taken because the interaction between the two is continuous, it's nonstop, and it's critical. So the career civil servants, as well as career military, our country would not be where it is today without them.
I totally agree. And I can tell you from the U.S. Navy standpoint, we couldn't operate like we do without them being the backbone of what we do.
Thank you very much for your time today, Cutler. And to everyone listening to Lessons in Leadership podcast, we'll see you next time.